Dependent origination. That's one of our projects for this VASA, our study project. And that very important teaching of the Buddha has got everything to do with the chain of causation, which keeps us on the spinning around in suffering. But there's another side of dependent origination, which is the opposite, the Dhamma wheel, which is it's not exactly doing the same spinning in reverse gear, but it's something completely different. A set of natural causes, natural capacities, which we all possess, which we can, if we can just get out of our own way, we can let nature take its course, and these tendencies towards liberation and spiritual fulfillment can lead us in the direction of wisdom and freedom. So this has been my kind of interest as we study, you know, why the mind keeps churning around in the same old pattern all the time. And then what is the other pattern? What's the opposite pattern? And so I've been searching in the suttas for the words, the language, the phrases, and the metaphors that point in the direction of this opposite way. They do sort of need to be understood together. This natural mind, which is trapped in a trap, as we have the different experiences that we have as we go through our life, everything that we experience, the tendency is to take those things on board in relationship to the self. So, this is mine or this is not mine. I like it, I don't like it. This is similar to me, this is different than me. This is good for me, this is bad for me. We go through life experiencing what we experience in the world, and in the process, unintentionally, we are fabricating this self that then becomes a burden and leads us to possibly making choices that keep us going on into the cycles of rebirth. Or if we haven't heard about the Dhamma, and if we're really on a different path, a person might even be taking delight in acquiring those experiences that are building up their self image, and in making those kind of choices which will aggrandize and protect and build up the sense of the self. We've all probably heard this talk about how that when one is identifying in an unwise way with an ego or a self-image that has been built up, then the effort that goes into defending and protecting that can become burdensome indeed. You'll have to have, as you build up your reputation as being a wonderful person, then you'll have to go on your Facebook and your different social media and be posting different stories and things that illustrate what a fine person you are and what a fantastic life you're having. And then in case some investigator might find out that you're not really like that, so then you might have to undertake steps to protect your reputation. I think you can even hire companies that do that, reputation protection services, and so on like that. This is all natural, and a normal person, I think, could know when they have gone too far, and they can bring in some modesty and some humility, and to realize the value of just being simple and authentic, so they don't get carried away in becoming some kind of a big person who has to have a larger retinue of soldiers protecting them. Nevertheless, even somebody who's a simple, humble, good, authentic person still has got further along to go in going to a different way of thinking, wherein they're not continuing to fabricate a self and fabricate a future. And one of the ways is the special variation on dependent origination, which is known as the supramundane dependent origination, or the lokuttara. Loka is the world, and uttara is the ultimate, or can be like beyond. So sometimes called transcendental dependent origination. It's got a series of steps that are going through joy and tranquility and so on, and culminating in liberation. And these, this is a onward leading sequence. So here's a sutta. I'm going to read you a little bit. These teachings about the supramundane dependent origination, one version has got a starting point in suffering, based on suffering, one eventually encounters a faith or confidence. And so then that confidence is the starting point. And then there are a bunch of other renditions of the same thing that start with a sila or ethics. So in this one, this is in the Book of 11s. It's called Making a Wish. An ethical person who has fulfilled ethical conduct need not make this wish, may I have no regrets. It's only natural that an ethical person has no regrets. If you have no regrets, you need not make a wish, may I feel joy. It's only natural that joy springs up when you have no regrets. It's so much more clear in Pali than it is in English. When he says, the translator says it's only natural, he's saying it's a dhammata. So the dhamma is, you know, the truth about the way things are. And it's also the truth about the teachings about the way things are. And in this case, the dhamma is that it's a natural path, but it's the path that is leading towards the wholesome result. And the rest of the steps that are happening here, that are starting with this gladness, are really, they can be interpreted in terms of states that you may encounter as you go through life, but they're really very relevant to meditation and things that can happen to you while you are on retreat or while you are doing your regular cushion meditation practice. These things can arise, but it's impossible to force them to arise. So it would be like if you are planting sunflowers, you can't force them to grow. You just provide the soil and the water and the sun and the warmth, and then it grows by itself. Or if you have a child, you can't make the child learn. The child learns naturally. You can provide the conditions to support that happening. But it's never something that is happening as a result of your willpower. That's why my idea about the theme for this talk is to about getting out of the way and allowing this fantastic spiritual progress, spiritual success, success in the Dhamma, allowing it to arise, but you didn't do it. It arose by accident. The only thing you did was you made a little bit of effort to get into the right circumstances to create some right conditions, and then be aware as these things are happening so that you can recognize them. And as a result of your awareness and recognizing, then this process is self-directing. You've got the pattern. You do not need to make a wish for such and such, because when you have the preliminary condition, it's only natural that the following condition will arise for you. Now, let us look a little bit more closely about what they are. The first is being an ethical person. That's a silavata. That's a person who has this characteristic, or a person who has fulfilled ethical conduct. That means someone who's developed some maturity in their ethics. Now, at this level, there may be some willpower involved for a person who has not yet gotten established with their ethics. In another way, it's only natural. If you see someone who's sad, who's weeping, who's in pain, even a little child will feel sympathetic towards that person who's in pain and would be wanting to go to them and do something to help them feel better. So this compassion is only natural. We had it from the get-go. Sympathy or the ability to recognize when we're mindful, if we can see, oh, this is harmful, or oh, this is dangerous, we don't want to go there. It was only because of having some confusion that we didn't really know accurately or well. We thought this would be good for me, but it turns out, oh, that was a big mistake. And so then if you realize, oh, that's a big mistake, and oh, naturally you won't do that again. So in that way, ethics comes up, it develops, it evolves naturally by hearing about the Dhamma, having good examples, having beautiful, skillful, wise ethical behavior around us in our life, and seeing how that works and seeing how much goodness follows from that, well, then we have a blessing of being in the company of persons who have these good qualities, and it makes it so much the more easier for us to acquire good ethics with a positive example, rather than having to acquire ethics from a negative example is maybe more challenging. Still can be done. There's an aspect of our ethical habits being well integrated. We've been aiming this way for a long time, And perhaps in the past it was difficult or challenging, but as it becomes habitual, then we're able to see and notice at a more subtle level what's skillful or what's not skillful. And we have found if there's a tendency for some negative emotion to pop up that causes us to do unskillful things, we've gradually learned through our life experiences how to tame that and how to actually retrain our subconscious self to become calmer and less prone to afflictive emotions come up that could lead to bad choices or unskillful things. So then this first wish that this ethical person has is to have no regrets. I'm going to give you the Pali because it's meaningful. Vipati Sara. Sara is a mindfulness or a memory. Pati in this case means against. Vipati is even stronger. So if we have memories, our thoughts, our ideas, our beliefs that cause us, that are against our own self, that are against our own happiness, if we think we're not worthy, if we think we deserve punishment, that's the kind of state that we want to escape from. And then the opposite of that is the ah makes it the opposite. So having no regrets. And it may seem like a bit of a conundrum to hear to say, to be an ethical person, then you won't have regrets. Well, that's a little bit obvious, isn't it? But then what if I did bad things in the past and I still have the consequences of the bad choices that I made in the past? What the Buddha teaches us about that is if you have to be forever condemned to suffering because of something that you did before in the past, then everybody in the whole world is condemned to endless suffering, because there's nobody in this entire world who hasn't done evil and unwholesome things in their past. Another way of thinking about it that the Buddha rejects is if you think, well, you know, I did some unwholesome things before, but most of the time I was good. That also doesn't really apply because the Buddha says, if you look over your whole lifetime and all the lifetimes before, going back through many lifetimes, you can see that even a professional killer might only, you know, be killing, 20 or 30 people in the whole year. So most of the time they're not engaged in killing. And yet that person has got some heavy karma to work with. The Buddha says, instead, this becoming an ethical person, what that involves is this realization, coming to wisdom, coming to a different understanding. The Buddha recommends not killing. And I can understand this. I shall now undertake the precept of not killing. And with that undertaking, that's that undertaking of the precepts is the basis for growth in the Dhamma. If one continues to make mistakes over and over again, then you may have more work to do in order to finally do this comprehension of, you know, it's really based on understanding, wishing for escape from suffering, wishing for welfare, wishing for one's own welfare, for the welfare of others, for the welfare of both, and seeing the role that ethics and morality, the middle part of the Eightfold Path, seeing the role that has is being on the path to happiness, and eventually we find out how. And so then it's not because of what happened before. It's because of what you're able to practice now in the present through your understanding and through undertaking and taking on board and having this commitment to the precepts. And as a result of that, you will have this state of non-regret, this clear conscience. There are many things that we do in our training that are further supports for having a clear conscience. I like to mention an aspect of our monastic training that I encourage people to do at home with your own friends and family or with your people in your workplace or whatever other groups you're involved with. We have a policy of if we do something unskillful, if we do a fault, we find a good friend and we acknowledge our fault. And we do it as quickly as we can and as honestly as we can. And then most of the time, just that acknowledgement is enough to clear off the negativity that's been planted. It's the burying it, keeping it secret, hiding it, and hoping to not get caught that tends to give power. So that, you know, we go to our colleague and say, oh, I did this thing, please forgive me. And then they have to forgive you because we have a rule. If someone asks for forgiveness, you have to forgive them. Otherwise, it's a fault for you. And so that's the way we do that. And this is all in the interest of supporting this theme, this psychology of non-regret. This is a starting point for gladness in the mind. This gladness in the mind is called pamoja. This is not a deep meditative state. It's kind of like a preliminary joy. It's very common among many different faith traditions that there can be this joy, and it's joy based on fellowship, kindness, and goodness. You could say that if you straightened out your view and managed to keep your morality straight, practice loving kindness and the Brahma Viharas, if you're a faithful Buddhist and you know the system, you may hear that as long as you can keep this up, if you were to die in a state like that, you would not have a bad rebirth. You would be born in a heavenly state or in a pleasant in a good state. And with that certainty, your life becomes kind of heavenly, and you got this natural joy. So I'm bound for heaven. With that joy, one has the possibility for what's translated here as rapture. It's called PET. That's a powerful, much more powerful, positive, joyful state, especially when you realize that whatever negativity or unskillful tendencies you have in the mind, whatever greedy tendencies you have in the mind, whatever tendencies to hatred or dislike that you have, whatever tendencies to depression or to agitation, that somehow at the moment, whether it be in deep meditation or it could be in life, you realize, oh, I'm free. None of these bad mind states are affecting me right now. And then realizing that freedom or that seclusion from unwholesome mind states, that's when the pīti, what's called rapture, arises. This rapture, this pīti, is definitely part of meditation. I know for sure that many people can meditate for years, and even after many years, they still, their mind is continuously distracted. They're not able to watch the breath without losing the meditation. They try again and again, and or they feel have painful feelings that meditation is even difficult for them. Because of the benefits of meditation, they keep making the effort over a long, long, long time, and then they might find that coming into this very joyful state within the meditation is not something that happens. If it doesn't happen, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Don't make it a problem. It won't come by forcing it. It won't come by wishing. It won't come by saying, if I just hold my breath and make a determination, I'm not going to move the body. I'm going to stay here for an hour or 5 hours or 24 hours, and I won't move the body until PT arises for me. That's even going to be blocking it from happening. But if PT doesn't happen, if you look backwards, go back down the backwards down the track here, and you say, well, how's my ordinary happiness? Are there ways that I could take care of myself to give up the habits in life that are causing me to be miserable and to feel free to take on and keep and develop and do over and over again those things that make me feel healthy and that make me feel better, that make me feel happy? Or if I look back and I say, I have a tendency that, the thing I'm supposed to do that deep down inside, I don't want to do that. I just want to go to the freezer at night and have some chocolate, or I just want to be contrary. I just want to argue. I want to do things. I know I shouldn't do them, but I want to do them anyway. Well, look more deeply and study, and you could find you can't force the PET or the bliss to happen, but you can get more honest with yourself about the preconditions and to see, is there something, like you think that chocolate will make you feel better, but actually, if you really think about it, you're really honest with yourself to say, well, actually, it doesn't make me feel better. It makes me feel worse. So why don't I give up that chocolate? Eventually we can find that all by itself, without forcing it, that PT arises. From PT, you don't have to wish, may my body become tranquil. Tranquility of the body is really a wonderful support for meditation. It makes it so much easier to be still and calm, and to have your mindfulness able to focus on more and more subtle and deep phenomenon that you're trying to observe. But if the body becomes painful, if the body becomes restless, then it may happen that this restlessness or pains in the body or itchiness or being oversensitive to stimulus, to sounds and so forth. You know, they could be, you know, you're trying to meditate and the refrigerator keeps humming and, you know, somehow that's, it's like it's too annoying. You're just not able to really settle because you can't stop the mind from feeling aversive towards that that noise factor, or you can't stop yourself from feeling aversive to some pain or something else going on in the body. So when this PT happens, it is able to create a kind of like a shock absorber, so that all of the like the stressful reactions or the disliking or the just the reactivity of the mind is sort of like it's something that's happening in the next room that doesn't impinge on you, and like you don't need to pick it up, right? So, you know, the dog is barking, but it's okay. I don't need to get involved. The body is, you know, the heart is beating, and the body is maybe a little bit too lively because I had some coffee or something like that, and I can feel the activity. But then when you have this PT, it's not like experienced as being distressing. You got this tranquility. And then when you have the PET is calming down, you get this tranquility, then the next step on this sequence is samadhi, which is including the idea of the unification of the mind. You could call it the tranquility, the stillness, the concentration of the mind, where the meditation feels like you can be attending to your object of meditation, and it's very unshakable. You can stay there for a long time. You won't lose your meditation. You've gained that samadhi, but you didn't gain it by trying. You didn't gain it by making effort. You didn't gain it by making a resolution. You didn't get it by exerting your willpower. You can't force the mind to go to samadhi, but the mind can go to being immersed in samadhi naturally when the conditions are right. And this is a state of being very well isolated from the tendencies of the mind. Not just the unskillful tendencies such as bad ethics or bad sila, not just the bad tendencies of the mind like aversion, liking and disliking, or greed or hatred or those bad tendencies, not just the bad tendencies like a conceit and egotism, but even being able to see how the mind keeps wanting to fabricate the fabrications, that is what has the danger to make you go spinning around in rebirth, that keeps you tied to this world. And being able to really see like the nature of the mind, or to see whatever you want to see, clearly, it becomes like the tadpole that was in the water all this time, and the water of an ordinary mind. And then they became a frog and they were able to jump out and they said, oh, there is something different. I have a choice. I can be either out here on the shore or I can be down there in the water. So then having this knowing and seeing normally what happens, we finish our meditation, our meditation retreat, and then we go back to work or back home. And then we have to do our chores, we have to do our activities, we have to take care of our family, we have to take care of our problems. If we're a citizen, we have to do something about the problems out there in the world. And in order to do those things, we have to arouse a lot of volitions and a lot of intentions, a lot of activation. And the clarity that we had when we were immersed in samadhi, the knowing and seeing that we had, is a distant memory. It's not easy to keep that when we're engaged in so many activities. But when we go back into an ordinary mind doing the ordinary activities, we may also feel disillusioned with it. So you know, the news is filled with so many stories, and the stories that are told in the news can be extremely gripping, both the ones that are uplifting and inspiring and the ones that are discouraging and maddening. But when we become disillusioned, our attitude is different. We say, you know, it's the nature of beings in this world that they keep fabricating all of this. This is called nibbida. So then you want to, and you can be like a bodhisattva and do so many beautiful good things in the world, but somehow you've become disillusioned. You don't have your self identity invested in it in the same way. That's what that nibbida is doing for you. But this nibbida, you know, it can create a great a freedom for people who are involved in worldly things, because they also don't have anything to be afraid of. The whole ego doesn't need to be protected anymore. And then if one has taken the reclusive path of simply trying to grow in wisdom, then they can go ever the much more faster in that, because they don't have the tendency for pride, ego, conceit, arrogance, clinging to views, getting into theological arguments with people, or whatever other bad habits that can happen in the other worlds that we can go into. But this this disillusionment comes naturally by itself. Like the authentic nibbida is something that arises by itself as a result of this whole cycle of practice. When you're disillusioned, you don't need to make a wish, may I become, what they translate here as dispassionate. Virajati, that means I'm going to say, can I not be emotionally triggered anymore? I'm sure you know that that's not possible to do with willpower. But when there's this change of view, this different insight, seeing it in a different way altogether, then the things that used to trigger you don't trigger you anymore, whether triggering to aversion or triggering to greed or triggering to anything else. And then if you would like to be an arahant, fully enlightened, fully awake, then you would wish for vimutti. This is the liberation from the cycle of rebirth and from all the defilements. But you definitely can't do that with willpower. The knowledge and vision of freedom rises naturally from the one who is dispassionate. So, this is a particular teaching. You may have heard it before. The thing that I just like in this particular version is this idea, this while you're sitting in meditation, if you have a chance to learn that list of some of the different things that can happen, that you can be experienced, that can be glimpsed, then it will come to you naturally because of your good practice. And as it comes to you, you can recognize it. And when you recognize, oh, this is something that I can remember, I can recognize. The Buddha said, this is something that can arise along this path of training. There's three different styles of meditation that we see a lot of. One is the super methodical method, like what you might get in some of the Burmese schools. Some of these sutta method that you see in especially Sri Lankan schools. And one is this sort of this methodless method, this very natural, subtle. Spontaneous and intuitive method of meditation. I think to realize what that particular sutta is pointing to, you have to learn how to get out of your way and practice this intuitive, relaxed meditation where you're not just clinging to a procedure, but you just come to the meditation cushion and be still and don't do anything at all. Now, I've left about 15 minutes for your questions and also for the closing.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Lovely, thank you. Thank you so much for your teaching this morning, this evening. I have a question, and I think it's been answered, but I would like to ask for your comment as well. Recently, I've been able to really rejoice in seeing Sila and others and have this joy of like, wow, that really touches me that that person thought of acting that way very intentionally. But there are still moments where I feel a fear when I notice the same person or others do something that's unethical. And I started to think when you were talking about Nibbida that there's still something in me that believes it can be harmed, that it must be protected. And so I think it, for me, just hearing you speak about that, I need to do some loosening. I can't create that to happen. I need to allow an authentic Nibbida to form and realize in its own time that there's nothing to protect.
Yes, thank you. It's true. If you saw a parent who had a child and the child, does something wrong, and maybe they're in a store or something, and a mom is like very upset and says, "Oh, be quiet, stop crying." And it's not that it's because she feels embarrassed. She wants to make the child be good so that she can feel better. So in a certain way, we're like that. Abba, we want to realize that it's the nature of beings. They do unskillful things and they suffer. We do unskillful things and we suffer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Talk a little bit more about mudita. It sounds like a state. Is this it a fashion?
This a nibbida?
Yeah.
Nibbida. It's translated as disillusionment. It could be compared to if the butcher throws a bone out. For the dog, and the dog gets a hold of this bone and he chews it and chews it and chews it and chews it and licks it and carries it around and you know, for a long time it's got a little bit of smear of blood or a little marrow on the inside, but eventually he's gotten from it everything he can get. There's nothing more in it for him, no more nutrition left, and the dog says, okay, I don't need it anymore, and he just puts it down and walks away. So that's a nibbida. So everything you could think of doing that's like the mind going towards some type of acquisition, like you're going to acquire and build up something for yourself, and this is going to be your way out of suffering. When you see that there's no acquisition that's going to lead you to success, success is actually what you let go of, not what you acquire. And then you lose interest in acquiring anything as a means to your spiritual success. Does that make it clear?
Oh, yeah. No, I understand that. I was a little unclear about the word because I...
Yeah. It's nibbida.
Dispassion. I'm dispassionate.
Yeah. Disillusionment.
Yes. I suppose you could really also apply that to moral outrage. That moral outrage is this kind of suffering and really see it for what it is. Then,
right. Yes. You know, there's some thoughts that we can think which are true, but still not healthy. Thinking those thoughts over and over again can make us unwell, even if they're true. Like that so-and-so always does that to me. And so we have the power and the freedom to choose, I'm not going to focus my mind on that. I can leave it alone. If this way of thinking is making me ill, I can find a different way, which is protecting my own welfare, my own psychology, my own mental health and spiritual health, and think about it in a different way. We can make those choices.